Hello, this is Miss Dell with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated January 12, 2026, Monday. I'm going to start with the front page article entitled "Nicor Seeks $220 Million Gas Rate Hike." ICC allowed last price increase less than 2 months ago. Illinois, Chicago. Nicor Gas on Friday filed a $221 million rate hike request with the Illinois Commerce Commission, less than 2 months after state regulators approved a $168 million rate hike for the utility. The company estimates that the increase, if approved in full, will add less than $6 to monthly gas bills for typical residents, customers, or 6.7% annually starting in 2027. Nicor distributes natural gas to around 2.3 million customers in Illinois. Consumer advocates expressed outrage with the move, calling on state regulators to reject the request, which comes only days after Peoples Gas filed for a $202 million rate hike on Monday. "I'm shocked that Nicor is proposing to raise rates again just 1 month after imposing its last rate hike," Illinois PIRG Director Abe Scar wrote in a statement. "Nicor is busting its customers' household budgets because it apparently refuses to live within its own." Illinois PIRG is a consumer advocacy group that often challenges rate requests by Illinois energy utilities. If approved in full by the ICC, Nicor's request will have increased by about 170% in the last decade, according to PIRG. An increase, it says, is significantly higher than the state's other major gas and electric utilities. Nicor said in a statement that the investment is needed to enhance the reliability of its natural gas distribution system, particularly through extreme weather, and to remain in compliance with state and federal regulations. That includes replacing aging equipment, inspecting and repairing over 400 miles of transmission pipelines, and safety-related replacement of over 45 miles of distribution lines, according to the company. Consumer groups challenge the assertion that these investments are necessary now, saying the company has tripled its infrastructure spending over the past decade and that Nicor has already replaced its old iron pipes that were at high risk of failure. The gas utilities deliver natural gas to consumers at market rates and make money on the delivery of the gas, not on the gas itself. These consumer groups argue incentives, overly aggressive spending, and infrastructure projects related to gas delivery. An analysis by the Future of Heat Initiative, an independent nonprofit that makes recommendations on utilities policy, found that gas delivery charges now make up 65% of customers' gas bills in Illinois, up from 36% in 1984. The conclusion the report finds is that customers pay more for pipes and delivery of gas than for the gas itself. The filing will undergo an 11-month review period by the ICC, giving consumer groups the chance to intervene and formally challenge spending requests. If allowed by the ICC, the rate hike would go into effect next January. If Nicor is granted this $221 million increase, it would push the utility's total rate increases to more than $1 billion in less than a decade, said Sarah Moskowitz, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board, a utility watchdog group created by the Illinois legislature. CUB will challenge Nicor's money grab, and we call on state regulators to crack down on the company, she added. We are deeply concerned that this sixth rate hike will push even more gas customers into hardship. Our next article, entitled "Fraud, Misconduct in Watchdog Report: Chicago Public Schools Hope Moses," Chicago Tribune. Chicago. Chicago's public schools watchdog released its annual report Wednesday, detailing dozens of the more than 1,200 complaints it received between July 2024 and June 2025. The report addressed accusations of pandemic program fraud, excessive overtime, stolen equipment, residency violations, and sexual misconduct by district employees. The Office of the Inspector General is an independent body that investigates allegations of fraud, waste, and misconduct within the district. The office does not disclose the identities of accused employees in the report. Pandemic relief fraud. The OIG reported closing two cases in fiscal year 2025 involving former CPS principals who defrauded pandemic relief programs, including one who received more than $41,000 in loans on top of her six-figure salary. One principal's termination hearing is pending with the Illinois State Board of Education. The other principal retired amid OIG's investigation, but a do not hire designation was placed in her personnel file due to unrelated conduct. The two principals joined the more than 20 investigations by the agency in previous fiscal years into CPS employees defrauding pandemic relief programs, as well as district charter schools that received over $43 million of forgivable loans from the Federal Paycheck Protection Program, in addition to their full school funding, the report said. About 400 government employees were recently investigated by the state for similar fraud. Past investigations into pandemic relief spending also revealed $28.5 million in good faith payments to bus vendors who performed no services during the suspension of in-person learning. These funds were intended for bus drivers who were laid off amid the pandemic, but were never distributed to them, the report said. The bus vendors agreed to pay the district back about $300 million, according to a previous report. The agency also found a 74% increase in overtime and other forms of additional compensation between 2017 and 2021, a year after CPS began receiving federal pandemic relief funds. More than 77,000 laptops and other technical equipment were also previously reported lost or stolen in the first year after the return to in-person learning, totaling $23 million, the report highlighted. CPS used the remaining $233 million of the $2.8 billion allocated to address the impacts of COVID-19 under the Federal Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Fund, the report said. The agency wrote that it remains committed to ensuring that individuals and entities affiliated with CPS who abused the public trust during the pandemic are held accountable. Other fraud mismanagement reports. The watchdog also found that former CPS program manager repeatedly falsified federal grant applications over the course of a year by submitting false enrollment data. The federal government required CPS to pay back more than $1 million, the report said. Another agency investigation revealed that a former CPS employee defrauded this district of potentially more than $135,000 over 3 years by reporting false or inflated work hours, the report said. OIG found that the school's remote work policy allowed staff members to get around CPS's policy. The report said 15 staff members at one school violated the CPS residency policy by living outside Chicago and that three of them lived outside Illinois. A school administrator lived as far away as Florida with her family for nearly 2 years and intentionally misled CPS about her residency status, according to the report. OIG's annual review comes on the heels of a November report that found CPS travel expenditures, including airfare and lodging, more than doubled between fiscal year 2019 and 2024. rising from $3.6 million to $7.7 million. Months prior, the district faced a steep $734 million deficit before passing a $10.2 billion budget in August of 2025. In response to these findings, CPS issued a temporary freeze on district-funded travel, except for travel tied to student activities. 355 sexual misconduct complaints closed. In fiscal year 2025, the agency's sexual allegations unit closed 335 cases related to sexual misconduct, with 55 reports having sustained findings of misconduct. The nature of those cases varied, with touching being the number one allegation reported. Overall, sexual misconduct complaints have steadily declined since 2023, while teachers still account for nearly 40% of all allegations during this time period, according to the report. In terms of demographics, 44 female students and 21 male students were identified as victims of the misconduct, ranging in age from 4 to 19. These victims and witnesses made the initial reports, exhibited enormous bravery, and potentially prevented more students from being victimized, the report said. Of the 55 substantiated cases, the unit, which mainly investigates adult-on-student sexual misconduct, looked into multiple occurrences of alleged sexual abuse that happened on a high school campus in the 2010s, involving 8 staff members. Reports about these incidents were made several years after the abuse occurred, as the agency's sexual allegations unit was not yet created until 2018. One of these cases includes an ex-CPS dean who was sentenced in August 2025 to 22 years in prison for sexually abusing a former CPS student when she was around 15 years old, occurring from 2013 to 2016. Other cases mentioned in the report involve sexual misconduct between teachers and students shortly after graduation. While the OIG did not find a root cause for the multiple occurrences of sexual misconduct on one campus, it recommended several policy changes to address systemic concerns, including adopting a policy that prohibits staff members from engaging with recently graduated or disenrolled students. Plans for a new policy are currently underway in the district, the report said. Our next article, Impeachment References Erased, National Portrait Gallery Cut First Trump Term History, Bill Barrow and Anna Johnson, Associated Press. Smithsonian, Washington. President Donald Trump's photo portrait display at the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery has had references to his two impeachments removed, the latest apparent change at the collection of museums he has accused of bias as he asserts his influence over how official presentations document U.S. history. The wall text, which summarized Trump's first presidency and noted his 2024 comeback victory, was part of the museum's American Presidents exhibition. The description had been placed alongside a photograph of Trump taken during his first term. Now a different photo appears without any accompanying text block, though the text was available online. Trump was the only president whose display in the gallery, as seen Sunday, did not include extended text. The White House did not say whether it sought the changes, nor did the Smithsonian statement in response to Associated Press questions. But Trump ordered in August that Smithsonian officials review all exhibits before the nation celebrates the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence on July 4th. The Republican administration said the effort would ensure alignment with the president's directive to celebrate American exceptionalism, remove divisive or partisan narratives, and restore confidence in our shared cultural institutions. Trump's original portrait label, as the Smithsonian calls it, notes Trump's Supreme Court nominations and his administration's development of COVID-19 vaccines. That section concludes, impeached twice on charges of abuse of power and indictment of insurrection after supporters attacked the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. He was acquitted by the Senate in both trials. The text continues, after losing to Joe Biden in 2020, Trump mounted a historic comeback in the 2024 election. He is the only president, aside from Grover Cleveland, 1837 to 1908, to have won a non-consecutive second term. Asked about the display, White House spokesman Davis Engel celebrated the new photograph, which shows Trump's brow furrowed, leaning over his Oval Office desk. Engel says it ensures Trump's unmatched aura will be felt throughout the halls of the National Portrait Gallery. The portrait was taken by White House photographer Daniel Torok, who is credited in the display that includes medallions, noting Trump is the 45th and 47th president. Similar numeric medallions appear alongside other presidents' painted portraits that also include the more extended biographical summaries, such as what had been part of Trump's display. Sitting presidents are represented by photographs until their official paintings are commissioned and completed. Engel did not answer questions about whether Trump or a White House aide on his behalf asked for anything related to the portrait label. The gallery said in a statement that it previously rotated two photographs of Trump from its collection before putting up Torok's work. The museum is beginning its planned update of the America's Presidents Gallery, which will undergo a larger refresh this spring, the gallery statement said. For some new exhibitions and displays, the museum has been exploring quotes or tombstone labels, which provide only general information such as the artist's name. For now, references to Presidents Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton being impeached in 1868 and 1998, respectively, remain as part of their portrait labels, as does President Nixon's 1974 resignation as a result of the Watergate scandal. And the gallery statement noted, the history of presidential impeachments continues to be represented in our museums, including the National Museum of American History. Trump has made clear his intentions to shape how the federal government documents U.S. history and culture. He has offered an especially harsh assessment on how the Smithsonian and other museums had featured chattel slavery as a seminal variable in the nation's development, but also taken steps to reshape how he and his contemporary rivals are depicted. In the months before his order, for the Smithsonian Review, he fired the head archivist of the National Archives and said he was firing the National Portrait Gallery's director, Kim Sajak, as part of his overhaul. Sajak maintained the backing of the Smithsonian's governing board, but she ultimately resigned. At the White House, Trump designed a notably partisan and subjective presidential walk of fame, featuring gilded photographs of himself and his predecessors, with the exception of Biden, who is represented by an auto pen, along with plaques describing their presidencies. The White House said at the time that Trump himself was a primary author of the plaques. Notably, Trump's two plaques praise the 45th and 47th president as a historically successful figure, while those under Biden's auto pen stand-in describe the 46th executive as by far the worst president in American history who brought our nation to the brink of destruction. Next, Nation and World Digest. Hamas says it plans to dissolve government. Cairo. Hamas said Sunday it will dissolve its existing government in Gaza once the Palestinian Technocratic Leadership Committee takes over the territory as mandated under the U.S. brokered peace plan, but the group gave no specifics on when the change will occur. Hamas and the rival Palestinian Authority The Palestinians' internationally recognized representative have not announced the names of the technocrats who are not supposed to be politically affiliated, and it remains unclear if the U.S. will be cleared by Israel and the U.S. The Board of Peace, an international body led by Trump, is supposed to oversee the government and other aspects of the ceasefire that took effect on October 10th. The board's members have not been announced. Germany lashes out at comments by RFK Jr. Berlin. The German government sharply rejected accusations by the U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., claiming that it sidelined patient autonomy, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. The statements made by the U.S. Secretary of Health are completely unfounded, factually incorrect, and must be rejected, German Health Minister Nina Warken said in a statement late Saturday. Briefly, DOJ. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell says the Department of Justice has served the central bank with subpoenas and threatened it to a criminal indictment over his testimony about the Fed's building renovations. The move represents a major escalation in President Donald Trump's battle with the Fed, an independent agency he has repeatedly attacked for not cutting its key interest rate as quickly as Trump prefers. Weather. Thousands of tourists were stranded Sunday in northern Finland after flights at Kitalia Airport were canceled due to severe cold. Finns are generally used to frosty winter temperatures, but this year's cold, which has affected wide regions of northern, central, and eastern Europe, is more severe than other years. Ukraine war. The Ukrainian drone strike killed one person and wounded three others in the Russian city of Voronezh, local officials said Sunday. Meanwhile, thousands of residents were still without power in Kyiv following an intense Russian bombardment. Syria. First responders entered a contested neighborhood Sunday in Syria's northern city of Aleppo after days of deadly clashes between government forces and Kurdish-led forces. Syrian state media said the military was deployed in large numbers. Virginia. Brendan Banfield, who had a relationship with a Brazilian au pair, was to go on trial Monday in what prosecutors say was an elaborate double murder scheme to frame another man for the stabbing of his wife, Christine Banfield, and Joseph Ryan at the Banfields' home in Northern Virginia. Mississippi. Congregants and leaders vowed to rebuild a Jackson, Mississippi synagogue that was heavily damaged by fire. An individual was taken into custody for what authorities said Sunday was an act of arson. Vatican. Pope Leo XIV baptized 20 babies Sunday in the Sistine Chapel, continuing an annual tradition that marks the end of the Christmas holiday period at the Vatican. Next, cities reeling as arrests continue. Agents rammed door down on Sunday after pepper spraying protesters. Rebecca Santana, Mark Householder, and Mark Van Cleve, Associated Press, Minneapolis. Federal agents carrying out immigration arrests in Minnesota's Twin Cities region, already shaken by the fatal shooting of a woman, rammed the door of one home Sunday and pushed their way inside part of what the Department of Homeland Security called its largest enforcement operation ever. In a dramatic scene similar to those playing out across Minneapolis, agents captured a man in the home just minutes after pepper spraying protesters outside who confronted the heavily armed federal agents. Along the residential street, protesters honked car horns, banged on drums, and blew whistles in the attempt to disrupt the operation. Video of the clash showed some agents pushing protesters back while a distraught woman later emerged from the house with a document that the federal agents presented to arrest the man. Signed by an immigration officer, the document, unlike the warrant signed by a judge, does not authorize forced entry into a private residence. A warrant signed by an immigration officer authorizes only arrest in a public area. Immigrant advocacy groups have done extensive Know Your Rights campaigns urging people not to open their doors unless agents have a court order signed by a judge. But within minutes of ramming the door in the neighborhood, filled with single-family homes, the handcuffed man was led away and soon gone. More than 2,000 immigration arrests have been made in Minnesota since the enforcement operation began at the beginning of December, said Homeland Security spokesman Tricia McLaughlin. The Twin Cities, the latest target in President Donald Trump's immigration enforcement campaign, is bracing for what is next after 37-year-old Renee Good was shot and killed by an immigration officer on Wednesday. "We're seeing a lot of immigration enforcement across Minneapolis and across the state, federal agents just swarming around our neighborhoods," said Jason Chavez, a Minneapolis city council member. "They've definitely been out here." Chavez, the son of Mexican immigrants who represents an area with a growing immigrant population, said he is closely monitoring information from chat groups about where residents are seeing agents operating. "People holding whistles position themselves in freezing temperatures on street corners Sunday in the neighborhood where Good was killed, watching for any signs of federal agents." More than 20,000 people took part in a variety of trainings to become observers of enforcement activities in Minnesota since 2024 election, said Luis Argüenta, a spokesman for Unidos Minnesota, a local human rights organization. "It's a role that people choose to take on voluntarily because they choose to look out for their neighbors," Argüenta said. The protests have been largely peaceful, but residents remained anxious. Minneapolis public schools were set to start offering remote learning Monday for the next month in response to concerns that children might feel unsafe venturing out while tensions remain high. Many schools closed last week after Good's shooting and the upheaval that followed. Continuing, California wildfires by the numbers. After twin infernos tore across opposite ends of Los Angeles County, the scars are still visible. Thousands of rubble with rebuilding slow, and the death toll showed how a wildfire under extreme weather conditions can turn catastrophic. 90 mph, the speed of predicted wind gusts in the mountain areas, red flag warnings were issued on January 6th for severe wildfire danger as Southern California was buffeted by the nation's notorious Santa Ana winds. Grass and brush were tinder dry after months of little or no rain. The National Weather Service warned it could be a life-threatening wind event. Firefighting assets were pre-positioned in areas deemed to be at especially high risks for fire. 59 square miles, the amount of land charred by the two infernos. That's roughly the size of the entire city of San Francisco. 31 lives, the number of people who died, 19 in the Eaton fire and 12 in the Palisades fire. 31 days, how long the Palisades fire burned before it was extinguished. Investigators determined the 37-square-mile blaze actually grew out of the earlier fire that started on January 1. 25 days, how long it took to put out the Eaton fire to be extinguished. It burned 22 square miles. $33.9 billion, the amount of federal disaster aid requested by Governor Gavin Newsom, the Trump administration, and Congress have yet to approve it. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, Sunday, January 11th. Please stay tuned.